Welcome to Behind the Biology, brought to you by ATCC. I'm your host, Dave Yarmush, and in this series, we'll be talking to Dr. Birgit Schule, currently at Stanford University, about her and her lab's work on Parkinson's disease. In our first episode, we get some background on Parkinson's, her perspective on why they're researching the genetics involved, and how their spirits stay high despite the task at hand. Good morning, Birgit. Then thanks for taking some time out of your day for us. You are an accomplished researcher of Parkinson's disease. Before we go any further, could you give us a small primer on the nature of the disorder? Make sure we're all on the same page.
Oh, yeah. So Parkinson's disease is a neurodegenerative disease. It affects about 1% of the population over the age of 65. And it's a progressive disease. So there are no disease modifying therapies to date. So everything is symptomatic. So you can get some of those symptoms in check, but you cannot like with infectious diseases treat it with a medication and then it's gone. So it stays with you 24/7 for the rest of your life. And the patients experience mostly motor symptoms. So that means they have shaking of their hands, they have instability, gait and balance problems. They also have mood changes. Some patients have cognitive changes, depression, anxiety, all those things. And also autonomic symptoms like constipation, loss of sense of smell. So it's not just a disease of the brain primarily, it's really a multi-system disease.
And it sounds really disruptive to any kind of day-to-day life, especially as it advances.
Right.
You said it had a genetic component. Is that a simple inheritance in that you have this gene, you have the disease, you have the disorder, or is it more complicated than that?
It is, of course, more complicated than that.
Well, that's unfortunate.
With what we know. So it's not just a monogenic disease. Like with a lot of late onset diseases, it's multifactorial, but there is a genetic component. And we'll talk about later on about a gene called alpha-synuclein, and that was the first gene discovered as being causative for Parkinson's disease when you have little point mutations in the gene. But then the gene that the part of the mutation or the type of the mutation that we'll be talking about are copy number variants of alpha-synuclein. So that's another different type of mutation that can cause Parkinson's disease. But since its discovery in 1997, over 90 Parkinson's genes or disease risk loci have been discovered. So there's a lot more to learn, but alpha-synuclein is the key role model for Parkinson's disease that we are following.
Great. Before we get into all of the science of it, I want to talk about you for a second. Sure. So you worked for your medical degree in Germany, right?
That's correct. Yeah, I got trained in Germany.
Mm-hmm. And I'm curious if you found a culture shock when you came here. But before even that, what brought you to the United States in the first place?
Since my early high school years, I wanted to come to the U.S. and I wanted to do an exchange year in high school, but that never worked out. So I didn't get selected. And so at that time, I just finished high school and went through med school. And then after that, there was still this kind of urge that I wanted to go somewhere else. And at that time, my husband also had a similar experience. And so we kind of applied together for postdoc positions in the U.S. And then we ended up at Stanford. So we interviewed in different places, but then Stanford was the one we both found a home for a few years.
And so you're still a professor there, right?
Now I am, but there was there are 20 years in between.
Right, you were a postdoc. And so was it during medical school or before or after that you developed an interest in Parkinson's?
Yeah, that's a good question. And a lot of people have a story that say, oh, yeah, my My grandma had Parkinson's disease, and that's why I'm interested. But for me, it was more that my mentors brought me there. So I had really wonderful mentors that worked already in that disease. So one is Dr. Christine Klein in Germany, in Lübeck. And she was really instrumental to discover and characterize some of the early genes like Parkin, PINK1, DJ1. And so it was just fascinating to listen to her, to talk to her. And so and genetics was also, an area that caught my interest, not during medical school, but I found that this is where everything starts, with the genes. And so that's what really matters. So it's a combination of genetics and then mentors, and then kind of the brain is fascinating too. So that's what brought me there.
Yeah, I agree. I mean, it's hard to overstate the impact of two good mentors on an entire career, right? I can speak for myself, as can you, that you can get fascinated with a topic you otherwise would never have been exposed to. Reading through your bibliography, which is extensive and impressive.
Thank you.
In case nobody said that to you before. And you mentioned the
alpha-synuclein.
Alpha-synuclein earlier. Is that the current focus of your and your lab's research? Because your work has spanned quite a few topics within this field alone.
That's right. Although for some reason we are always circling back to that one gene. So we've worked on or I've worked with colleagues and collaborators on Parkin, on LARC2. Those are other genes that with mutations can cause Parkinson's disease. I worked on other monogenic diseases that cause dystonia syndromes. That's right. But I don't know why. I always felt like alpha-synuclein is, there's still so much to learn about, and especially when you have the wild type gene, not with mutations, no point mutation that changed its configuration, just the wild type gene. If you have too much of it in your cells, that can cause the disease. And so that's still fascinating me. It's also changing disease onset. With every copy of the gene, you shift the disease onset by about a decade. So if you have 4 copies, you get the disease around age 35. If you have 3 copies, then it shifts to 45. And then if you have 2 normal copies, then you're kind of in the regular range, and then you have kind of little kind of variance in the promoter or other regions that can increase the expression a little bit, and then it shifts to the typical sporadic disease. But then the other thing is also we found patients that have deletions of this gene, and that I always thought that's a good thing. Yeah, if you have too much, it's no good. So if you have less, it might be a good thing, but it's actually not the case. So these individuals have developmental delay and are in the autism spectrum disorder. So those are children. So that's another interesting area that we haven't looked at. And we don't really know where it all comes together. It could be that there are synaptic changes that occur because alpha-synuclein is a protein that functions at the synapse, at the presynaptic terminal. So that's something we are quite interested in. And I think this is fascinating to kind of also move from this neurodegeneration to kind of neurodevelopmental diseases. So and finding that link there is quite exciting.
Yeah, so forgive me, it sounds like, and I don't know this, but I'm going to ask, it sounds like alpha-synuclein is involved in impulse relays in neurons. Is that what its purpose is? Is that what the gene is for?
So it's not quite clear what its function is. So wherever you look in the cell, there it binds to curved membranes. So it's important for neurotransmitter vesicle release at the synapse. So that's okay. Where it interacts with the whole protein complex. So that's one of the key functions, we think.
And what you're trying to find out, I see. So I imagine that's on the list, but what are the more daunting challenges in working in Parkinson's research? You've said that we've discovered some genes related to it within the last 20, 30 years. The disease has been, you know, known for longer than that. So I imagine the research has been broad throughout this time period. What are we currently facing?
Yeah, well, it depends where you're from, what angle you're looking from. Yeah, so some people say, well, this is an elephant, and then you can look at the tail, at the kind of trunk or whatever. So that's kind of where we are, and it also depends on what area you're coming from. So are you coming from the clinical area? Do you kind of want to find out what are the symptoms of disease, the onset? We know that there's a long period before you even have motor symptoms like the shaking, and so on. So what's happening in these 10, 20 years prior to someone is coming to the clinic and said, oh, my little pinky is shaking, there's something wrong with me, or so that's one area. So like these early endophenotypes, biomarkers is a huge area. Mm-hmm. So there only has been recently a biomarker discovery, and it's again alpha-synuclein, so it always pops up.
It always comes back.
So it can be detected in the CSF, in the cerebrospinal fluid of patients with alpha-synucleinopathy. So people that have Parkinson's disease, but not other neurodegenerative diseases. So that's a key area that really needs more research. And then on the basic science side, there is a lot happening currently in the field of neuroimmunology. So that has been really a hot topic. A hot area, I would say, in the last decade. And then thinking about therapies, because we know now so much about these genetic causes, you can now target those genes with very specific therapies. So that's another big new field, or something we can actually do something about. I mean, before it was, you would think about how can you keep the cells healthy for the long time. So certain antioxidants or mm-hmm. brain-derived neurotrophic factors, in that arena, people were kind of thinking about attacking the disease. But now when you know there is a particular gene that has a defect, you want to treat that particular defect, because then you also don't have, hopefully, any off-target effects or side effects. So
that must be even harder, considering you're looking at a copy number issue in so many cases, right? Because you can't, like you were talking about before, you can't deactivate, say, all three copies of a more or less identical gene, because at least some of it is necessary for healthy function.
Right. And that's something that we are facing. So my lab is developing a gene therapy for Parkinson's disease, and our target is, guess what?
And what else is there?
I know it's controversial. I mean, there's some people say it's just a bystander. Yeah. So some people don't consider this a real issue. However, there are these families with these mutations, with these copy number changes, and that really tells us it can be causative. So, I mean, coming back to gene therapy, so what we are trying to do is we're using CRISPR tools to regulate gene expression. And as you say, how much downregulation is good? So That's something we're trying to find out. So we have in vivo models and in vitro models, like human iPS cells, that we use. And with these CRISPR tools, we can basically build little dimer switches depending on the small guide RNAs that we can target to specific regions in the promoter of alpha synuclein to adjust the levels as we need them. But we still don't know how much we need, what's the right level. When you do it in vivo, you also need to consider what's the route, how do you administer it, what's your vehicle to get it in. You want to have it expressed for a long, long time, but also the levels of your genes need to be adjusted. And then, of course, I mean, there is, again, the immune system, like that's policing everything. And as soon as there's something foreign coming in, it gets alerted, and we need to make sure we stay under the radar to keep it in it expressed. Yeah.
Right. You mentioned iPS, that's induced pluripotent stem cells.
Yes.
I imagine those come from more than one source, more than one human donor. Do you need to know the full genetic makeup or as much genetic context as you can from the human donor? I'm only wondering because we've been talking about gene expression, and that's often complicated and multi-tiered, and there can be relationships, cross-promotion, for instance, that would make this less simple than just alpha-synuclein has X number of copies. So how does that affect
Well, that's a very complex question. And where should I start? So yes, we have multiple donors, but we have one line that's also deposited with ATCC that's coming from one particular donor. And if you think about these alpha-synuclein copy numbers, I oversimplified it and says there are multiple copies of alpha-synuclein, but in fact, these are big chunks of the genes that are multiplied, or we have three copies. Those also include additional genes. But if you look at families from these copy number variants with alpha-synuclein, the only overlaying gene is alpha-synuclein. There are others, left and right, upstream and downstream, but only alpha-synuclein is the one that everyone shares. And also when you look at the clinical presentation of symptoms, they don't differ. So you would think if there's 10 other genes involved, they may have different symptoms, but that doesn't seem to be the case. So that is for alpha-synuclein. For other genes, yes, I mean, we are outbred, yeah? So we are not lab mice. And there is, of course, a lot of variability, biological variability between these induced pluripotent stem cell lines from different donors. So yes, the genetic makeup is important, but on the other hand, you also want to tease out the real signal. So the way people think about this now is to use gene engineering to use one master cell line that's from one donor that's highly characterized, ideally with no other mutations that we know can cause other problems. And sometimes what happens is you first correct a couple of mutations before you start on your gene of interest or disease of interest and then introducing mutations. So with CRISPR engineering, there are several efforts to generate panels of mutations for neurodegeneration. So there is the INDI consortium at the NIH that's generating lines, CRISPR lines for Parkinson's mutations, for Alzheimer's mutations, for frontotemporal dementia. So that's an effort. So in this case, we're kind of reducing the variability to one line, and then we just believe by making these CRISPR edits there's only one difference, which is not true, but
but it's conceptually closer to true.
Conceptually, we believe it's only at that locus.
So would part of this panel involve the capacity to do sort of early screening pre symptomatic onset, or is that already standard?
Well, that's also a complicated question.
That may be further down the line.
Yeah, because here we're trying to make that leap from whatever we see in the cells, like the changes, the molecular changes, or the changes in cellular assays, and make that leap to the clinic, because you said symptoms, yeah, or clinical outcomes. So
right, so now we'd be talking causal relationships.
So can we tell, if there is a change in mitochondrial function that's really causing the tremor? So that's a leap. So, and there maybe it's possible to come in with longitudinal data from patients, because then you can see over time the changes. Mm-hmm. We can look also deep. A deep phenotyping, doing a lot on one patient, a lot of assessments, imaging, blood biomarker, and so on. So maybe that gives us a hint, but the direct relationship between the molecular biology and the symptom is hard to make at this point.
Right. It sounds like it may end up in a more personalized medicine versus a catch-all population level diagnostic.
Right. Personalized medicine, yeah. And also if you think about it in another way, when we say there are over 90 Parkinson's disease risk loci, maybe we can call this also a under the umbrella of rare diseases. Mm-hmm. So maybe we can say, well, it's an alpha-synuclein disease. It's not Parkinson's disease. It has a lot of signs and symptoms, but it's alpha-synuclein, or it's the LRRK2 disease, or it's the Parkin disease. So that it's more like a rare disease concept instead of putting everything under one umbrella. And that might be the issue also with clinical trials in the past, because we lumped everything together under one phenotype.
Well, looking forward to finding out. If we can take a step back from the science for a second, I was browsing through the shulalab.site and found the life in lab section.
And
everyone in those photos just looks so cheerful and so happy to be working there. And perhaps yourself most of all. You always have what I've come to understand is a very characteristic and full smile. So I just wanted to ask, between the intensity and the significance of the work everyone in your lab is doing, as we've been discussing it so far, how do you maintain what are clearly such high spirits at all times? Because I have a hard time believing that those pictures are all staged.
No, they're not staged. You've seen some of those group pictures. I mean, those were taken by some young photographers, and they just had us sit there, and they were just waiting, and they were kind of fiddling on their cameras, and they just wanted to take pictures us being relaxed. And so those pictures are actually the best. We're just kind of chatting and hanging out, and so it's nobody's on the phone. Everyone is kind of happy. So yeah, I mean that's the real Shule Lab. How do we maintain that? I think it's important to be excited about your work, and I think I found my passion, and I think that's something I can convey. So every time I come to work, and I'm excited to be here, and I'm excited about what I'm doing. And then also for my folks, they are engaged, they are fun, brilliant, and it's just a pleasure to work with them because they are excited. We are a team, so nobody needs to be afraid of being scooped or not getting the recognition. It's also important to be open and transparent and be able to talk about things yeah, also complicated and difficult issues. I think the reason why I can do that is, or I don't know, how should I say that? So maybe we have to cut some things. I also had mentors that were the opposite. And so I think I learned from those negative experiences. And I know for myself, this is not what I want to give to my mentees. So mm-hmm. that's what I want to say. Yeah.
Well, I can only imagine that you are the exact type of mentor that you have appreciated so much in your life. Dr. Birgit Schule is an extensively accomplished researcher at Stanford University in the field of Parkinson's genetics. She and her lab don't exclusively investigate alpha-synuclein, but that is a consistent area of interest, and with good reason. Next week, we'll be talking more about how the methods of science have changed and the impact that takes on her specific work.